And we're on. So, welcome, internet world. All this introductory stuff is going to be edited up, but I'm sitting here with a couple of guests, and we're going to talk about some interesting things.
Technically, you're the guest here.
My mind is blown. So, for those of you who don't know who I am Dr. Rewa Dionandan, number one best-selling Amazon.ca author. In the category of epidemiology, which is like five people buying a book in a given hour, which makes you a bestseller. I'm okay with that. And I'm sitting around the table right now with two very special guests, even though I'm actually the guest in their home. I'm with Dr. Graham Sanders of the University of Toronto. Excellent. I have to edit the affiliations out because you won't be saying anything too embarrassing, I guess. And I'm sitting with the lovely Aparna Halpe, who doesn't want to participate. So instead, she's sitting here marking exams, but I know as the conversation unfolds, she won't be able to help herself.
As we're sitting more and more idiotic, but yeah, I think she'll have to jump in.
So the three of us are all educators.
And we're not actually educating right now.
So I'm an educator in the sciences. Graham Sanders is an educator in the softer art of Chinese medieval poetry. He is also the progenitor of young daughters who are almost adults, and I've dated many people's daughters who are almost adults.
And I don't know if I like that segue, but
and it probably is someone's daughter who is almost an adult. So we have experience both, how would we put this, propagating education and perhaps guiding the education of others.
As in the market desire.
As the market desire, exactly. Now, the audience may be wondering, why are we talking about the Marquis de Sade?
I thought of the Marquis de Sade. That's what grading does to you.
All right, Mother Truckers, let's get on this topic. The topic I want to talk about this particular broadcast is education and educational, call it what it is, educational reform. Now, I thought about this because Graham had posted on Facebook a while back that he had a conversation with his daughter convincing her to take a science class.
That's right.
And I want to start off by asking Graham, why do you think it's important for him to take a science class?
Well, the short answer is...
Keep going short.
To be well-rounded.
I'm average human size for people of my interaction. We call round. Oh, we're down. Sorry, go on.
It's going to be a one-man podcast. It's popcorn. No, I just thought that it would be important for her to have a knowledge about how the world works and have a different viewpoint on human experience.
But doesn't the humanities teach us how the world works?
Well, a certain facet of the world, yeah. A largely verbal facet of the world. And...
So let's be honest now. Was it really about the desire to have a rounded education or about a more measurable advantage in the competitive world?
No, actually, that's funny because that's how you took it.
Yeah.
You said that you just wanted to take science because you don't want to be paying for her living expenses when she's 40 years old. But no, it was actually just about an educational goal in itself. There's no utility involved in my calculation because I think actually it's pretty... narrow-minded to make your educational choices, particularly at the level of high school, based on utility. I think right through your undergraduate, you should be trying to get as broad an education as possible. And then in your undergraduate, you know, maybe by your second year, start specializing.
I would tend to agree, but we're at a point in social history now where people need to be investing in relevant skills earlier. Is that not true, do you think? For the purpose of
that's
employment.
The argument. All right. And I think that's the argument which is, I think it's false on a number of bases. One is it's a utilitarian argument, and the skills that you will learn, and I'm not being very articulate about this. I don't think a university is...
Some educated you are.
I don't think a university is a place to learn purely practical skills. Right. So if you're after purely practical skills, there are vocational schools, there are community colleges, you know, there are other venues for that. But if you're going to a university, I think, as is implied in the name university, it should be a very broad approach to acquire.
I never thought that. It's the name, isn't it? Yeah. University left us to teach.
And also the other fallacy, I think, is that any knowledge that you learn by the time you get, particularly because the technology is developing so rapidly, by the time you get into the workforce, is going to be old knowledge. So I think you're going to pick up more of what you need actually once you're hired. I'm not a technology CEO, but I think I would rather hire someone that has a really sharp mind, can use words well, obviously has mathematical facilities and whatever else they need. But I don't care whether they're up, they take a course in X programming language or that programming language, because they're going to have to learn what they need to learn once I hire them. So I just think it's turning universities into vocational schools in order to...
What I've taken from what you said is that you can't spell fallacy without phallus.
We have recording our every word here.
For those who can't see, the microphone at the center of the table is pretty much a big metal penis.
Yeah, but I'm not intimidated.
I'm slightly intimidated. It's uncircumcised. So it's culturally biased.
Really?
All right. So
that derailed pretty quickly.
I think it's stayed right on the right rail. I was given some thought about how to weight appropriate topics for education in general. And obviously, we're going to have to sort of distinguish between elementary, secondary, post-secondary, lifelong learning, and so forth. I had a conversation with a friend of mine a while back, Dr. Nicholas Berriman, a superstar biostatistician, for those interested in hiring one, a plug for Nick. And he was saying, for him, the most important thing that he would want any graduate of any educational program, not necessarily university level, to have is an understanding of why we need to have a control group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was kind of interesting. And I thought
that's a pretty basic concept, though. That's not something you need to spend a lot of time in university on anymore.
All right. I guess we could have a podcast. But I suppose you can teach it, but is there an absorbed understanding of why it's needed? And, of course, the ramifications and the fundamental theories underlying how we get to that point. And what is a control group? How do you select participants in the control group? All these things add on to it. But his bigger point is, I guess he comes across most commonly in his arguments in life, the inability to express why this bit of evidence is more important than that bit of evidence, because a basic understanding of a scientific process is missing.
I think what you're driving at there as well is the understanding of principles behind things.
Oh, look at that. Yes.
So I would rather see an education concentrate on principles and then move towards
principles.
Right. My analogy is for computers. Right. So you there are two types of computer users.
Oh, here we go.
There's the person,
the non-Apple users, and the slow.
We do the whole Lombardo Echo thing. Church versus Catholic Church. There are people who know that if I press this key and this key and this key, this is supposed to happen. And they memorize the series of keystrokes. And if that doesn't happen, they don't know what to do. Right? Because they don't know why they press this key, and that key. And there are other people who actually understand the principles behind how a computer operates and can sit down and figure out, okay, without having read the manual, or having read the manual is preferable. But they can figure out how to work their way around it and get it to do something. Right? It's not about memorizing keystrokes, it's about understanding how the computer operates, how a program operates. And that analogy, I think, could be
behind science. Maps versus the process.
Yeah, so teach principles. Yeah. And then the facts will, obviously, they can't be empty principles. There will be facts that come along with the principles. But
empty principles? Like Malcolm Gladwell?
That didn't take too long.
No, it's not at all. That's the wrong speech.
I actually thought the podcast was going to be
Gladwell 3?
A long show. No, Gladwell bashing, but I'm surprised we got this far.
So, I like where this is going, because I would like for us eventually to end up on maybe a base set of precepts upon which to build perhaps an idealized educational system. Right. I gave this some thought years ago, where I thought about what the most important subjects that I would like the members of society to have comfort in. I came down to communication, however you define that. It could be language, it could be writing, it could be oration. Basic mathematics, and history. And that's about it. Of course, how you define those things will vary.
So you don't have science in there?
I think science flows from the combination of history and mathematics or psychology. I think, hang on.
That's what literature is for.
Yeah, interesting. No, you made a good point, though. So understanding the human condition, as they say, that doesn't really come out of what I've talked about, has it? I've been skills-focused.
Communication did the rest.
Right. So the gap in my framework is the non-skills approach. Okay.
Philosophy, with that?
Not quite the same thing as psychology, but because philosophy, in a way, could have a connection with chemistry, depending on how you want to look at it.
I've never actually thought of psychology as a separate sort of... I don't even know where I slotted it in my intellectual training.
I'm making so many enemies to this broadcast. I have psychologist friends listening to this who know the common joke I always make is psychology is not a real science.
Does it try to be a science?
It's a real science. I want to be angry emails.
Can you use the scientific method?
I can, just often, but I can. But is the scientific method the fingerprint for real science? I'm not sure that is. Right. Scientific method to me actually has a hell of a lot of art.
Maybe we should just be teaching philosophy.
I think so. Yeah. In fact, maybe people need to understand that the term scientist did not exist in our vocabulary until about 150 years ago. Isaac Newton called himself a natural philosopher.
There's a lot of flow from that. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a philosophy of, like, every philosophy of history, philosophy of science.
Hence, we are doctors of philosophy.
Wasn't
I like being a doctor of philosophy.
I was on a plane once and
I'm not sure it's done anything to, you know, to my general well-being.
Really? You mean you can perform surgery on philosophers? You're a doctor.
You're a philosophical outlook in life.
You're on a plane.
I bought my ticket online. I filled out a station. I can do that. despite having a degree in the soft Chinese poetry, I call it, and be able to operate a computer. And under the salutation, I checked off doctor. They had Mr.
Right.
The doctor. They didn't have professor.
Right.
So I am a doctor. So I have a doctor. Bought the ticket. Got on the plane, in the middle of the flight.
Of course.
Stewardess comes over in a very lower,
right.
Concerned look at her face, very lower tone. Excuse me, doctor, but we have a medical emergency. I was wondering if you could assist us.
You should have said, yeah.
Question about Chinese poetry? That's not your medical emergency. I don't think I can assist. And then she looked at me like she was disappointed.
Yes,
I'm like, I'm a doctor?
Exactly.
So that's the last time I checked.
I did it for a while, and then they'd actually asked me, are you a doctor of medicine. You were a doctor of medicine. They actually phrased it doctor of letters.
Did you say doctor of letters?
Yeah, I was very impressed. Yeah. The medical doctors that I know never, ever identified themselves as.
Because they don't want
to. Liability issues. And,
right.
You know, being disturbed.
I suppose if someone's having a heart attack, you'll get up and help them. I would hope. If you were a doctor, despite not having checked off the doctor.
My HR refuses to acknowledge me as a doctor. Because they refuse me. Because there was, they sent a letter referring to me as Miss. Mm-hmm. And I said,
Miss?
Yes.
M-I-S-S?
Not even M-S?
No.
Oh, wow.
And I said, you know, by this token, I don't have a doctor, and I have there's a certain sort of judgment about my preference, right?
Interesting.
Yeah. And then she's changed.
This is at your institution.
Mm.
Well, what is a doctor, really? I mean, we think the official definition has to do with the highest level of education, has to do with the seeking of knowledge or the mastery of not necessarily the existing knowledge, but the potential existing knowledge. My lack of eloquence is being exposed slowly as my room kind of flows. Yes.
Interrupt with another anecdote.
Please rescue me from my rambling.
This will be my function during this podcast. Throw in random.
So you're on a train this time.
I wasn't on a train. I was at my convocation.
Ooh.
And the doctoral gowns were crimson. And so I was walking.
From which university, Mr. Sanders?
From Harvard.
Oh, well.
Not only in Harvard, of course, we have crimson gowns.
The Harvard Upstairs School of Poetry and Gun Repair.
Top Chinese gowns.
Purple and gold.
Oh, that's nice.
So, can you
join? I was complicated. To the best of my abilities. I've never done it before. So, I was striding along confidently and complicating away, and and it's a big outdoor ceremony. You have to march from some area to another area to hear the speech and so forth. And all the parents are lined up. And this parent ran up to me and said, "What's after the PhD?" She was looking for her kid. She's like, "What's after the PhD?" And I said, "I don't know, Dad."
Oh, right.
And then she said, "Yes, yes, very good, but who's behind you?" Oh, okay. And really, I mean, I thought, what do I do now? I mean, I've got this degree.
Well, now you go to community college and get a skill.
Yeah.
Right. Well, now the word doctor, I mean, they're, you know, JDs, doctors in law.
Okay.
Are medical doctors of the same academic standard as a PhD doctorate? I don't know what these things mean anymore.
I'm not actually, I have to go look up doctor.
Yeah.
I assume the medical doctor was probably later than the original use of doctor. But
I would think so as well. I remember when I was a kid, my uncle explained it to me. He said a doctorate simply means that, yes, you're a master of a certain subject area, but not necessarily that you have all the answers. It's just that if someone asks you a question, you know how to go about finding the answer to it.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's more of, again, an understanding of the mechanics and the process of inquiry, mm-hmm. still being mastery of content.
The Chinese term for doctor is bo shi, which means a master of erudition, but erudition implying broad knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Knowledge of broad, right on.
Mm-hmm. Knowledge of broad.
Dr. Sanders said that, not me. If you look at the right letters.
I'm not killing that.
All right, so let's revisit my
framework. Edit this part out.
I don't think so. Let's revisit my framework. I had history, mathematics, and communication, which we can seek to expand.
But you're the ruler of the world.
Yeah. Right.
So you spend a lot of time thinking about how you would rule the world. Yeah, I do that too, actually. I would banish the combustion engine. But
would you really?
Yeah, I could rid the combustion engine.
Right. On my list of things, that would not be in the top 10.
Really?
Most of it would be, you know, the accessibility of certain kinds of women to me.
Probably, if you phrase that properly, that could just be number one. One to five. You put a lot of semicolons in there, okay. So mathematics, science, and history.
No, I don't mathematics, history, and communication. But Poppy brought up the... the very important part of some kind of philosophy.
Psychology.
Psychology.
But I think psychology flows from philosophy.
Yes, it certainly does.
Right. So maybe Graham is correct that maybe the approach should be entirely philosophical. But then I really do think that mathematics is critical. Not just as a skill, but as a way of thinking.
Yeah.
And I don't think it can become a philosophy, but it doesn't begin that way. And it's hard to make it into one or to see the philosophical foundations of it. Read and write and arithmetic, that's what we're down to again. And rhetoric. and more R's.
History, you know, of the three that you've mentioned, mm-hmm. history seems the most loaded.
Yeah.
Right? I can understand mathematics being fairly neutral, even like language acquisition, facilitating language, but history, I mean, that's a difficult one.
You're right, it's politically loaded.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have to be defined per jurisdiction. And I have easy answers there.
Right.
The best we can say is the most factual aspects of history.
Yes.
Once you start interpreting, you know, why certain things happen, then you're into a different domain entirely. How I originally conceptualized history as being simply a list of facts.
Precisely. And I mean, last year, the situation where my students didn't know who the Nazis were. Hadn't heard of World War II. An entire generation that just doesn't have a simple fact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, I love this course. We get to tell horrifying stories in our teaching experience. We all adore our students, first of all. I adore my students. One of my favorite stories is I was teaching a fourth-year class in international health and development. I'm not saying which year it was, because I know my students are listening. Oh, that was my year. No. And I mentioned NATO. And not a single person in my 100 students who were self-selected to take a course on international health and development knew what NATO was.
Wow.
And this is in Ottawa, which has a strong military presence. So I was a little stunned by this.
The NATO has not been used much lately. It's true.
But still.
You think it would pick it up elsewhere?
By that token, this is all about communication. You know, whatever we hear, this is what we retain. Our words, the parameters are based on whatever we are picking up right now. No facts.
That's true. That's true. We all know Bieber was arrested today.
Even the idea of facts, listening to facts is problematic.
It's been a problem, absolutely.
Because you have to bring a selection.
Yeah, we can't agree on what is a fact.
Mm-hmm. And even you choose what gets in there, what doesn't, on a very basic level.
Very, very true.
You can't learn everything. So it's making that choice.
And also, again, the language of facts, mm-hmm. right? The civil war in 2009, was it civil war? Was it
the Sri Lankan civil war.
Sri Lankan civil war. Was it a genocide? What was it?
Right.
And it's going to determine how that fact goes down.
Totally.
Which takes you back to communications, if you want to call it that. Or language is how you use words to label things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which takes you back to philosophy, mm-hmm. right? So I think maybe we're down to mathematics and philosophy, perhaps.
Maybe we're back down to woodworking and electronics.
Now, if we could figure out a way to shoehorn mathematics.
Is mathematics politicizable? Is the teaching of mathematical skills, techniques, histories, philosophies politicizable?
Huh. It depends, I guess, if mathematics is trying to produce a uniform, all-encompassing view of the realm of numbers, that's already exercising a form of control.
Right? Interesting. Is it culturally biased? Mathematics can be.
You said the teaching of mathematics. Mm. That's always going to be about dissemination. So that's always going to, you know, determine who receives and who doesn't. And we see this already in classrooms where students are sort of panicking depending on how smart they are. They go to a math science stream or an art stream. The dancers go to the art stream.
Did you say dancers or dancers?
Dancers.
Dancers, okay.
Right.
The dancers.
Well, my favorite,
I like that.
Yeah.
The dancers, yes.
The best part of we're talking about is the ones that end up in the wilderness with our canine brethren, the dancers with wolves.
Oh, I slapped at that. We can edit that out. Oh, okay, so what you're bringing up now is at what point do we start this scheme that Raywan is going to foist upon the world? So is this something that starts at a very young age?
Well, that's a good question, right?
There's an argument to be made that we have to teach information up to a certain point.
Principles. My original conceptualization of this idea, not that it was well thought out, was probably mediated by vast quantities of imbibable fluids, was that this would be the nature of elementary school education. Mm-hmm. And then anything that came before that would have been a parental kind of education around basic social skills and some factual knowledge.
Did you rely on parents for that?
No.
Yeah. Because I actually... At an elementary school level, I would actually rather teach kids how to be good people.
Interesting.
Right? Yeah. How to be empathetic, how to help other people.
There was an interesting study that was talked about on the Freakonomics podcast. Didn't actually read the original study, but they talked about how the only thing that is measurable as an impact that parents have on offspring later in life isn't factual knowledge,
right.
Isn't the skills. It's all about how to be a good person. So all the advantages that we seek to import upon our children, like studying Taekwondo lessons or all those other classes, etc., don't really pay dividends. The only thing that happens is, did you figure out how to relate to other people? That's the parental advantage.
And how much you spoke to them using encouraging language. Yeah, that's the other thing that's...
Conversely, how you teach a child to be a bad person. I mean, that's psychology.
Right. I heard that person, and I was thinking, yeah, that's what Bruce Wayne learned. Yeah. I mean, that person.
That person.
I'm
thinking you both did that.
Unfortunately, I can't.
Remember the Batman TV show from the 60s?
Yeah.
Remember when the episodes where Batgirl was going to be in and the opening had her motorcycle pull up in the cartoon and you got really excited because Batgirl's on this one? Yeah. No?
No.
I guess I don't know about Batgirl. Okay, then. Moving on to the topic. So the other thing I was thinking about in the education program is to switch from the parental time to the elementary school time. Let's skip over high school for now. And go to the university.
You're still teaching. You're still teaching them philosophy at an elementary level. If you're teaching them how to be a good person,
yeah,
you can still call that philosophy.
I think this how the Spartans would do it and how we do it are different, right?
Yeah.
So obviously these things are culturally and historically mediated.
And also, of course, if you don't teach them a certain kind of skills and at a certain development stage,
they're
given a mental stage. Good
mm-hmm.
Lord, I didn't even have their own.
There's no rum involved in this podcast. It's a dry, alcohol-free environment, just so you know, listeners.
That's it. It's gone. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back to
I'm thinking, what if we solved the world's problems
right now?
Wouldn't that be fantastic?
That would be.
Wow.
That just means that everyone needs to have lots of sex with lots of orgasms all the time.
Listeners, this podcast is not foreplay. Just so you know.
I'm in wholehearted agreement with Dr. Alfie, the person.
I believe I need to go home now. Unless this even get those stories.
Someone had to say it, didn't it?
They went around New York interviewing people, right? And that old lady who used to be something.
Yeah.
And they asked her what the secret was of her happiness, and she said, lots of sex.
There you go.
It's not even
ordinary. That's what we're on this planet for.
Masturbation?
Yeah.
Good, because I'm okay there.
All right.
I'm with you there.
Because,
you know, actual sex requires, you know, talking to people or having a human relationship of some kind.
Right.
I'm not good at that. Anyway, moving on to I was trying to project.
You were, weren't you?
I was trying to project into the future what in the Western university system will look like. Right, because all of us work in post-secondary education.
Western?
Well, because I think the Asian and Middle Eastern models may have a different
kind. It's all online, though.
This is one of the things I'm
saying. It's not Western anymore, is it?
Right. So are we in the West, I think, are embracing the online model a bit faster for a lot of reasons having to do with cost cutting.
Well, also India and China. A lot of we're marketing courses
to them.
Yeah.
Outsourcing grading to that.
Which is great. I would love to be able to outsource my grading to TAs in India.
Yeah.
Right?
It's available.
I know, but the unions kind of prevent me from doing it.
Right.
Because, frankly, there's.
I have to say, though, in my case, in my particular discipline, I can't see how somebody else would grade my students.
It is tough. Unless you're asking just for language and grammar.
Yes.
Because you know the idiosyncrasies of each student, or?
Well, also because of that conversation you start up, in this process, my opinions are getting changed just as much as my students' opinions. So if a student brings something fresh and innovative into a paper, somebody else might completely miss that because they haven't been through that process with that student.
And then you would be robbed of the opportunity of responding to that. Yeah. So that would destroy the whole essence of the education, which goes back to maybe the underlying problem with your vision of having the education system from the top down, just saying everyone has to learn this, this, and this.
Right.
What about individual difference? At what point did we realize that maybe this isn't working for this?
Yeah, you're right. So back to the streaming idea then.
Yeah.
Cool.
I don't know. Does a 3-year-old really know what their potential is, or even how to respond to it?
No, which is why they should have a broad education as possible,
yeah.
For as long as possible.
Well, I think we're still missing the conversation about what's the purpose of education.
Mm-hmm.
Is it for the enlightenment and the betterment of the individual? Is it to produce a functional person to participate in society?
Right.
Yes.
Surely both.
Surely both, right. But these philosophies tend to weight on one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Interesting.
This is a very large topic to try and get our hands
on. Well, you're a large man, Graves. The beauty of audio-only podcast.
We're all laughing for different reasons.
I know. Hang on. I forgot that. That's not good. Listeners, he is wearing clothes. I'm not, but he is. So the purpose of education. These things have actually been cyclical, have they not?
Yeah.
It's gone from
the very fact of education itself.
That's typical.
That's fairly modern.
Well, let me ask a very simple question, or a simple but direct, not simple but direct question. Should this be the responsibility of the state, or should it be left to non-state actors?
No, the state.
Okay. Yeah. Why is that?
Because the other one sounds too libertarian. So it's already crossed off.
I mean, I would say the state because the enforcement of universal standards and the avoidance of perhaps some problematic niche ideas that may not be evidence-based, such as extreme religious education.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, the state does make mistakes, and the state does have an agenda, which is propagandistic.
But if you're going to have a society in which your remuneration is based on your intellectual ability to some extent, then if that's the way things are going to be, the state has a responsibility, I think, to make sure everyone has as much opportunity to develop their intellectual capital so that they can take advantage of that.
Is there a role for non-state actors?
Well, there always is, I suppose.
In what capacity?
There should always be. In order to have dissenting voices, you have to have diversity.
By non-state actors, do you mean private schools?
Sure, that's one way to interpret it. Religious schools, homeschooling, that's not state overseen.
Right.
Or private universities.
Which apparently in Ontario, homeschooling is very lax. Mm-hmm. They don't have a curriculum you have to follow, they don't have testing. You just get pushed to homeschool your kid, and that's the end of it. And I'm not too comfortable with that.
I've seen it work pretty well.
No, I'm sure it can work well, but I don't trust every parent to be able to.
Right.
Should
be some oversight.
Yeah.
How about just inventing RNA injections where you just give a kid an IV full of liquid schooling?
I don't know
who. Oh, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Look at that. The Matrix really is a wet dream for people who don't want to go to school, isn't it? That's all it is. It's the high tech equivalent of sleeping with a book under your pillow, hoping that it's absorbed into your brain.
Oh,
that's the next episode we'll talk about. Technological solutions.
I mean, some people argue that our whole model of education, which is to put a bunch of kids in a classroom and line them up at desks and make them listen to an authority figure, is all about serving the capitalist system where you need client workers, right? It's the industrial vision of our society.
On the other hand, if you don't follow that model and suddenly the graduate ends up in a situation where he has to experience that setup, then they're at a loss. Is there some utility in
that? Well, they're at a loss because they refuse to accept the status quo of being commodified as a worker. Yeah.
Right, or is there some utility in having the educational format resemble as much as possible the quote-unquote real-life experience?
That I don't agree with. I think education should enable you to question the status quo, not conform to it.
But are we back into producing leaders and leaders only?
Yeah.
And I'll be leaders.
The people that espouse the whole leadership mantra are the ones that are most committed to the uber capitalist vision, I find. In which, to be frank, that's the best position to be in, right?
You can be Frank. I'm Frank.
I'll be Frank. This is going to sort of German sort of video device.
Wow.
What was my point was, yes, the whole leadership thing is that it's the business school. Okay. The business schools are all about this leadership thing. And it's like, which is unusual to me, because like what that means tacitly, what they're saying is that business school is only for people that will become CEOs and maybe vice presidents or something. But everyone else, all the workers, they don't need to learn about leadership, right? So it's a very sort of narrow way of carving up the world.
Is leadership a skill that we should espouse in our educational system?
You know, it's interesting you say that, because something I've noticed is the rhetoric of the CEO, you know, the drive to success, power, and all this stuff. That is exactly the key rhetoric for the community college.
Right.
And it's fake. It's completely fake. Apart from the fact that most often kind of sell sell posters and advertisements properly. But it's used as a particular kind of ideology to motivate these students or at least to succeed in their program.
So
not really worth it.
So as you get closer to the institutions which are training workers, community colleges, that rhetoric of becoming a leader becomes more prominent,
mm-hmm.
right? That's interesting.
I mean, these students, the real chances of them becoming quote-unquote leaders
are
much smaller.
Yeah,
right?
So you have to
A lot of this is confounded by the sad reality that the people doing the educating or developing these curriculum programs, their raison d'etre, their motivation really isn't to produce a certain kind of graduate, it's to bring in market shares, to attract students.
Yeah.
So it's a problem with the university system that's long bothered me. It's the market for universities is students. The market for students can be employers, or it's life experience or some kind of other self-development. And the two sets of markets are not aligned, to use business terminology.
Mm-hmm.
So it really comes down to what is the purpose of all this. If we can't agree on a purpose, we're kind of lost. Or we can have a list of purposes, but agree that they must be weighted in a certain way, or at least all acknowledged.
If I could just jump in.
Mm.
If it's not just about producing good workers, and if once upon a time, I think we actually did sell the idea of achieving any sort of individual satisfaction, potential fruition, whatever, through the university experience, we've completely lost that now. Now, even at the university level, we're mostly talking about producing good workers for careers, right?
Yeah.
So that isn't factoring in any longer.
Yeah.
So our shift in education has gone completely towards commodification and consumerism.
At least in the rhetoric. I don't think the actual content has shifted all that much.
No.
The attitude of the students has shifted, though.
Yeah.
I will get so many students that come to complain to me about having a low mark, and the way they frame it is, if I get this low mark, I'm not going to get this scholarship, and then I'm not going to be able to apply to law school, and my career is shot. Mm-hmm. And so you're ruining my career by giving me this low mark.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was able to bring it back, I was like, no, I'm giving you a low mark because the essay is poor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I'm concerned with. The rest of it is not actually entering into this educational moment. The educational moment is you're supposed to learn how to write this essay.
Is there a solution? I'd like to think that one of the solutions is to create free education for the purposes of learning.
Oh,
and a separate stream for the purposes of certification.
Right. So a divorce certification from learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the models that's being pushed at the several online.
That's a fantastic idea.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
One of the models being pushed online is we will give the content for free.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a piece of paper saying you finished this, then you're going to pay me.
Right. I mean, that's a bit of a medical school model, isn't it? You can't become a doctor until you've passed the exams, right?
That's right.
The law, the bar.
Yeah.
I mean, you can conceivably go through all medical school, go through law school, mm-hmm. and not write that.
But you can't be licensed.
You can't be licensed, so you've done it. So maybe it's that sort of vision. Now, what does that mean then? You write a set of exams in order to get the PhD?
Yeah. Well, PhD is a different kind of reality, right? That's a different, I mean, doesn't have a whole lot of utility in the world except to teach this PhD.
Because what's going to happen is that all the schools will then naturally fall in line of teaching towards the exam, right?
Yes. But we already have that. So with the medical admissions exams, for example, these, there are endless services you can purchase to teach you how to write these exams.
Right? How does medical school get around that, then? Why is medical school not just 4 years of how to write the exam?
Well, the distinction between medical schools and the medical board exams. So the board exams, if any, in your profession, the way I understand it, is that once you have become an MD, you have to sort of enter, for lack of a better word, depending which country you're in that field, and then at the end you write the board exam so you've been certified.
So there's a practical experience component,
yeah,
in intern and resident and so forth.
Right. But you can be a doctor simply by finishing medical school. Second you graduate, you're
a doctor.
Depending on jurisdiction. I actually don't know, to be honest.
So what if we build that model? Not, I'm just
yeah,
thinking out loud. What if we build that model into other professions that you have to spend time teaching? You have to spend time.
Right. But then you have situations
what
like
in
high schools in Ontario where you need volunteer credits, you know? So you must spend time volunteering.
Yeah.
So if you have to do it, it's not volunteering.
Yeah.
It is kind of funny. But some kind of model must be made, but I think the secret has to be the divorcing of education from certification.
Hmm.
And I think ultimately you're going to have employers who no longer trust marks as a benchmark for skill.
Well, that's the issue.
That's the issue. They're going to have their own admissions test themselves. I mean, I already do in my field.
Mm-hmm.
I've been to job interviews, even at my level, a PhD epidemiologist for drug companies, where they give me a test before the interview starts.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would imagine then would happen when you have groups of people that would self-select to, some groups would just want education for the sake of education,
yeah,
and other people would just go straight to certification,
sure,
have the cheapest or most efficient route,
yeah,
however they get certification, they would follow that.
Sure.
Would you be comfortable with that, or wouldn't you want to force everyone to have an education and then later worry about it?
Ideally, yeah, but we currently have a situation where people who aren't interested are being, quote-unquote, forced to learn the more complicated philosophical aspects of education and are just going through the motions, and really aren't absorbing the teaching anyway.
Yeah, like the bachelor's degree is the bare minimum now.
Precisely.
Like people think they just have to have it.
Right. So by divorcing the two, I think we, as professors, we get the great pleasure of teaching only those who wish to learn.
Universities become much smaller then.
Right. So the economics has to shift as well. How they go to sustain themselves becomes different. For the lab sciences, for example, it gets really hard. Lab teaching is very expensive. A lot of universities now are shying away from teaching hardcore lab skills, for example, to save money.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah, I think. Well, definitely programs are sort of, we're not hiring as many lab-based people.
Right?
It's the whole reason we can't afford to sustain them. Something has to be. Now, in the meantime, in Asia, where there is more money now growing, there's a greater investment in more broad-based kinds of institutions. So maybe the old-fashioned classical education model is being shifting over to the Middle East of Asia.
I think part of what's going on is that rich people aren't being taxed sufficiently so that the education system is being starved of funds, right? A lot of what you're talking about is expensive. So we're talking about how do we, you know, do these things to make the most of the limited resources we have, which is ignoring the larger question of why are all these resources being concentrated among 1% of the population and not being used to better, you know, the 99%. I mean,
yeah,
that's a question too. So.
As the economy compresses, there's going to be greater pressures to create an educational system that services the business sector or the employment sector. This is a reality. So we have philosophical concerns about this. Do we have utilitarian concerns? Do we have concerns that it's not the right thing to do? I mean, I can't in good conscience criticize that approach because it pretty much has to be done to save the economy. On the other hand, I want people around me to have read the classics. I want to have good conversations.
That's if we were married to this idea of measuring value in terms of money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm inspired for me to say that we shouldn't do that, but
mm-hmm.
maybe there's a way of getting outside that model that says all of our goal of education is to make sure people become productive members of society. Productive equals making lots of money. That's kind of the underlying assumption that's under that. What if we have other ways of measuring being a valuable member of society and being a productive member of society that are not necessarily attached to making
money? That's a really good question. And I think that's really a fundamental, it's a philosophical question, but it's a question of defining of the nature of our society. So all of these things aren't simply the domain of the Ministry of Education. They're not simply the domain of the Ministry of Industry. This is a global societal conversation about what is valuable to us. Right, so we're all familiar with the Bhutanese model of gross domestic happiness, for example.
Bhutanese?
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the Bhutanese model.
Well, Bhutan.
Yeah, I know.
I wasn't so sure if you're mocking my use of the word.
No. I was mocking your assumption that I would be familiar with Bhutan.
This may be an urban myth, but I've heard it mentioned so many times, must be true. So the Bhutanese have a measurement called gross domestic happiness.
They aim
to meet as an indicator of societal performance. Now, how they do so, I'm not entirely certain. But they made a decision that they're...
even the fact that they're trying to do that, is good.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So maybe it's the fundamental flaw in our post-Keynesian economic outlook that is a problem, where we define worth in terms of economic growth. And that's the fundamental problem with ecological degradation, with poverty in general, et cetera.
Which actually really drives me crazy, because in terms of ecological degradation, if you frame, even in economic terms, what's happening in the environment, it's bad, right? It's going to lead to less money, eventually. But
not in the short term.
But not in the short term,
And it's not the first time this happened historically.
Right.
That's true.
Well, look, we have one live viewer listening to this podcast right now. I'm kind of concerned about who that might be. We've been talking for about half an hour.
The NSA.
So I think we should end this right now, and we can start up again after a few drinks and the topic. So I've been speaking to Dr. Graham Sanders and Dr. Aparna Halpe, who have been kind enough to lend their expertise and unabashed perspective to this most critical question. He says, as the eloquence finds him again in these closing moments of the podcast. Thank you very much, Mr. Nurse. Talk to you later.